From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the presidential candidates are reacting today to their performances last night. This morning on Fox News, Donald Trump blamed what many have criticized as a poor performance in the first of three debates on a bad microphone.
I had a problem with a microphone that didn't work. I don't know if you saw that in the room, but my microphone was terrible. I wonder, was it set up that way on purpose?
Speaking to reporters on board her campaign plane, Hillary Clinton shot back.
What about his stamina?
Anybody who complains about the microphone is not having a good night.
Okay, there's that. Let's dig in with Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Good day.
And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Rick, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be with you.
Well, let's go. Kay, start with this day after. This morning on Fox, Trump also wouldn't give himself a grade on his performance, but gave Hillary a C-. There are some focus group results in. CNN had one. It showed twice as many viewers thought Clinton won last night's debate. You're in Iowa. What are people there saying?
Well, in talking with the people who are on the ground here, it sort of seemed to stop what may have been the bleeding, or as some people have called the bedwetting, among the Clinton folks. Mm-hmm. She had an enthusiasm gap, and this has made up for that. People saw her perform to a standard, and so the Clinton forces are pleased. In regards to Mr. Trump, people saw Trump be Trump, and they are pleased with his performance as well. As for those undecided voters, there aren't very many of them in Iowa at this point. It's hard to tell whether either of these people made the case to that block of undecided voters.
Jeremy, I don't think we've heard bedwetting yet in our discussion of campaign 2016.
Well, and in fairness, by the way, Trump gave Hillary Clinton a C+.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So it's a little grade inflation. Okay. We should get in there. But Rick, what are your thoughts on how they did last night?
A Trump C+ is obviously an A+ for your opponent. I think you have to grade on that curve. I actually think Donald Trump more than held his own for the first 20, 30 minutes of the debate. I think every time she attacked him personally, he turned it back to a general argument about why people are frustrated with the status quo. But then I feel like her prodding, her poking made him crumble. And as the debate wore on, he got less and less appealing, probably to a lot of voters, as he reverted to form by the end of it, attacking Miss Universe. Suggesting that she had gained too much weight, talking about Rosie O'Donnell all over again, saying that Hillary Clinton doesn't have the look or the stamina to be president. That's bad Trump. That's not the Trump that supporters want, and that's not the Trump that can reach out to voters who might be on the fence.
Well, you know, Rick, go ahead, Kay.
But I think that the Trump supporters that I've talked to this morning, they loved when he leaned into the microphone and would say, wrong, wrong. They loved him sort of fact-checking Clinton and fact-checking the moderator.
But some of the things he was fact-checking.
That's the Trump.
Right. But some of the things he was fact-checking, they were not accurate fact-checks. For example, he said that he hadn't said that the global warming was a hoax from the Chinese. And in fact, he did say that.
Right. But at what point in this 2016 campaign, which started in 2015, has a fact check of Donald Trump changed the trajectory of his campaign?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I wanted to ask, Rick, you said that you thought the first 40 minutes or so was strong for Trump. I've heard other commentators say that. But, Kay, there was so much interruption between the two candidates. Let's just listen to a little bit of that. And then I want to ask you about how women might have viewed that. Let's listen.
You haven't done it in 30 years or 26 years.
Well,
any number you
I've been
to
a senator.
You
Donald,
haven't done it.
And
you haven't
I
done
have
it.
Been a
and
Secretary of State, and I have
your
done
Your husband signed
a
NAFTA, which was one of the worst things that ever happened
well,
to the manufacturing
your
industry.
That is your
you
opinion.
And he's getting credit for being strong on the trade questions there. But, Kay, I saw tweets. One went out that said, Donald Trump interrupting Hillary Clinton is what every woman in America feels every single day. That's being seen as strong, but is that going to be seen as strong by everyone?
Well, we used to call this block of voters soccer moms. Now people are calling them white, suburban, educated women. That seems to be a target audience for both of these campaigns. And to that group, what Trump just did there in that clip that you played may have been offensive. You know, I would also point out that in 2012, Mitt Romney was seen in some of these flash polls after the debate to have won that first debate with Barack Obama. So I do want to add a note of caution that, you know, what is gelling, seeming to gel today, it may indeed sort of fade away as the campaign returns to, you know, what had sort of been baked in here was that people had a strong opinion about Donald Trump, either positive or negative, and they had a strong opinion about Hillary Clinton, either positive or negative. And it's a very, very narrow group of voters that these two people are trying to convince. On any given day, you can have a poll in Iowa which shows it to be a nail biter in this battleground state. Trump seemed to be pulling away here. He's coming to campaign here in Iowa tomorrow. She, Hillary Clinton, will be here on Thursday. Early voting starts here on Thursday. So we'll see if what happened in one event on one night can change the trajectory of this campaign here in Iowa.
So, Rick, I was watching the debate at a friend's house last night, and after it was over, by the way, there was a huge Uber and Lyft surge because everybody was trying to go home after the debate. But I get into this car, and the driver has some right-wing talk radio on. And one of the things that one of the callers said was that they thought that Hillary Clinton had the questions in advance. She must have had the questions in advance because she obviously knew what her answers would be, which is not true. But the other thing that was being said was that 30-year line from Donald Trump, she's been around for 30 years and she hasn't done any of these things she's talking about, was very effective. What do you think?
Well, I think it's ridiculous to suggest that she had the questions in advance. I wasn't part of the process from Lesser Holt, but that's not right. The case, I can guarantee. But I do think she studied, and she was proud of that studying. And I think that line that she had about how she's been preparing for the debate and also preparing to be president was effective. That said, I think the counter from Trump was Trump at his best during that debate, when he's able to say, you've thought about these things for 30 years. Where has the action been? That channels the frustration, the anger, the angst that so many people have, that fires up the Trump voters. And it does raise that question in this outsider year. Do you want a status quo establishment candidate, or do you want the sort of radical change that Trump is ready to bring? That, to me, is the central argument. When you get beyond the bluster and the name calling and everything else, that's the choice.
Go ahead.
And appealing to women voters, I think that part where she talked about doing her homework really was the appeal to women voters, as opposed to women voters being motivated with Trump badgering her during that piece of the debate that we heard earlier.
Well, she also brought up some moments. Taxes, his not revealing his taxes was one, which many feel that was a big score for her. Maybe another was his stand on the housing crisis. Here's Clinton and Trump on that.
Donald was one of the people who rooted for the housing crisis. He said back in 2006, gee, I hope it does collapse because then I can go in and buy some and make some money. Well, it did collapse.
That's called business, by the way.
9 million.
Kay, your thoughts. That's called business.
Well, one of the things that I found most fascinating about this debate was how much of the debate online, on Facebook and on Twitter, was dominated by Donald Trump. I think if Hillary Clinton had some sort of a big moment, and everyone would be citing that moment, that this race could have really turned on a dime and really changed how we're talking about this race. Sure, we're talking about Hillary Clinton doing well on a debate stage, but we don't yet have data that shows us that this debate has really changed how voters view either of these candidates.
Some of the things that happen in the debates that are most important, it turns out in the end, are little things. They're not the big policy stuff,
right.
The substantive things, but little things like how they address each other. Let's listen here to a little bit of this. This is Donald Trump speaking to Hillary Clinton early in the debate.
Now, in all fairness to Secretary Clinton, yes, is that okay? Good. I want you to be very happy. It's very important to me.
And he called her Secretary Clinton for the most part. He did flip into Hillary a couple times, and then listen to how she addressed him.
Donald, it's good to be with you. Donald was very fortunate in his
Donald
life.
Was one of the people who rooted. Donald thinks that climate change, and this is something Donald has supported.
Rick, how important was that, what they called each other? And in terms of getting under his skin, was that important for Hillary Clinton?
That is one of my favorite details inside this debate. We were told in advance that the campaigns had agreed that they would address each other as Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump. Mm. You did not hear Hillary Clinton say Mr. Trump
not
all
once.
Night long. He said, how are you, Donald? And you know, I know that Trump aides call him Mr. Trump, Mr. Trump, Mr. Trump. Nobody that I know calls him Donald. Maybe Melania does. But I think that was designed to tweak him just a little bit. And when you saw the barrage that she hit later about accepting loans from his dad and his business failings and his failure to disclose taxes and the suggestions around that. That was the strategy, get under his skin. And I think that Hillary Clinton knew exactly what she was doing, even in addressing him as Donald.
Kay Henderson, we got about a minute here. Jeremy mentions it's the little things. It's the appearance. CNN had kept them on a split screen all night. Mm-hmm. We just heard some of Donald Trump sniffing. Howard Dean sent out a very odd tweet saying that perhaps he was on drugs. But what do you think about the appearance of each of the candidates?
Well, of course, that's what dominated Twitter in the first part of the debate, the sniffling. There was a hashtag for it. Obviously, the way people appear on television is important. And that was something that was dominating Twitter about, you know, how she was smiling at points in the debate, how he was scowling at points in the debate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's just round one.
We'll see what happens next time, which is coming right up next week, the vice presidential debate. Rick Klein of ABC News and Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A warning, our next story is disturbing, may even be traumatizing for some listeners. It is for the author who tells it. Authors live with their characters for months, for years. So how could Affinity Konar live with Joseph Mengele, called the Angel of Death at Auschwitz for the way he calmly performed unspeakable experimental surgeries on twins and little people and albinos during the Holocaust? Well, maybe it's bearable because also in Affinity's head, Mengele's victims, a circus family, an albino named Bruno, and the twins Stasha and Pearl. Through them, she makes us look at the horror they experienced, but also fall in love with their resilience and magical thinking. As author Anthony Doerr says, it's a book about the most odious of crimes that also manages to have the lightness of a fairy tale. Affinity Konar's debut novel is Mischling, the Nazi word for mixed breed, and she drew on stories of real-life survivors to tell hers. She joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City. Welcome and congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and you just said something before we started that it's difficult for you to talk about this. I was glad to hear that, you know, because this is such a difficult topic. Why were you drawn to it?
I think I was always sort of drawn to the unspeakable in a certain way and to the effort to try to articulate it. But you don't imagine that there will come a day when you will actually have to talk about it.
Well, and how did that happen? You credit all the other books have been written, and many have been written, nonfiction in particular.
Yes, there was one book in particular that just gripped me at a very young age. I found it when I was 16. It was called Children of the Flames by Lucette Lugnato. And this book tells the story of the twins of Auschwitz, but also the story of Mengele. And I feel like my interest was first sparked by the injustice of Mengele, the fact that he was never captured. He would never accounted for any of these horrors, these crimes. And then over time, I found myself shifting my focus, as it should have been, over to the twins.
Are you having difficulty now?
Oh, I feel like I will never be okay talking about this, to be honest. It still feels very fresh, especially now that I'm hearing from people about it. Yeah. I've been privileged to read poetry by people who experienced this directly. A woman who, her mother was a twin who was unable to remain with her own twin, a woman who was able to come to America while her twin perished. Yeah. So, yeah, I had a strange feeling when the book was done, a strange sort of loss. And now it's a very different kind of trajectory. It is reliving it in a different way.
This is traumatic. Let's try in a way that we can to explain, because you say perished, and that becomes an almost antiseptic word. These twins, they are separated because Mengele wanted to see, will one survive and the other not? And the operations are unspeakable. They have organs removed. They have needles in their eyes. It's grotesque.
Absolutely. You know, you start to wonder how much you can bear doing this kind of research. The photographs are obviously things that you don't ever really recover from.
Yeah. Well, but then you will also read about twins like Eva Moses Kor and Miriam Moses Zeiger, twin sisters who were incarcerated in Auschwitz, experimented on by Mengele. And it was Moses Kor who co-wrote the book Echoes from Auschwitz, Dr. Mengele's Twins. You found something in this research that also made you think, oh, there's something here that's also a life force.
Oh, absolutely. You read these narratives and you also find a sort of innocence that's so strange, and you wonder how they were possibly able to cling to it and to each other. I mean, Eva, in her memoirs, will speak about the darkest moments. She'll speak about even, you know, after liberation, during the death marches, being separated from her sister Miriam. And they miraculously find each other again within a sea of people at these one barracks. And they start referring to these barracks as their lucky barracks. Mm. And the language of that just always struck me. You know, the love that they had for each other just carried over everything.
Well, and again, to make clear what we're talking about here, Eva Moses Kor later remembers a set of gypsy twins who Mengele sewed together at the back because he wanted to see if he could make a Siamese twin. And she listened to them scream for days. Gangrene set in and they died. You work that into your account as well.
Yes, because it emphasizes how not only ruthless these experiments were, but also how pointless. It's hard to imagine any sort of scientific mind really thinking that that was going to yield a result worthy of attention.
Yeah. It's so disturbing to read, you know, these children with their organs sewn together. But the thing that compels us on is, again, this sense of whimsy. These children who are trying to figure out their reality, both when they're out in Auschwitz, but then also after they're, quote, freed, they still have to make their way as children with animal cloths wrapped around them and no shoes through snow to try to find family or a place to live. And you have one of your twins escaping. Can you read a section that has a little bit of that? Are we in a nightmare? Are we in a dream? Where are we? As they come upon what they think is a temple.
Okay. So, like a brass bell sprinkled with snow, the straw temple rose from the earth with a steady determination. As we neared, we saw that we were not the only ones that this golden column had drawn in. It appeared that bales had been removed from the lowermost of the stack to create a burrow. We could see the discarded piles of hay flung about, their golden threads strewn on the ice, and through a flimsy panel of straw at the rear, we could see a peepery of eyes. They were scattered throughout in the manner of a constellation and with equal glitter. The eyes were friendly, I thought, but I'd been wrong about the friendliness of eyes before.
And of course, the eyes turn out to be other escapees from Auschwitz trying to get some warmth from the cold in a giant pile of hay bales. Again, how much did this parallel the real-life stories that you'd heard of?
It was a really interesting process of being sort of inspired by the personalities. I didn't feel comfortable taking the direct arc of any of their stories and mimicking it on the page. It was very much more a matter of paying tribute to their spirits rather than step-by-step their journeys back home.
Well, and you were also inspired by another story, Gisela Pearl, a real-life Romanian gynecologist sent to Auschwitz, who gave you inspiration for another major character of yours, Dr. Miri. Dr. Miri oversaw the children in Mengele's labs and also a Jew. We're not sure what to think of her until we find out that, well, as the real-life Dr. Pearl did, your Dr. Miri saved women. How did she do that?
She has the terrible task of preserving lives while ending others. She had to perform abortions on women in order to save them within the camp, because to be a pregnant woman within the camp was a terrible thing. You were absolutely doomed.
Because Mengele would want to perform experiments on you.
Yes, he would vivisect women. And these were not just simply cases where Mengele would abort the children. These children would be made to suffer as they died in just extraordinary ways. And Gisela Pearl would save the lives of the mothers, but it absolutely haunted her that she had to abort the children in order to do this. Yeah. And, you know, she would later have a sort of peal in her head of, please, God, let me deliver a healthy baby. Later in her practice, it was something that always followed her.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the real-life Gisela Pearl tried to kill herself, was interrogated in 1947 when she went to New York on suspicion of assisting Nazi doctors in Auschwitz. She does have to, in some cases, help Mengele perform some of these terrible experiments, but she's sort of doing that while, on the other hand, saving women by performing these abortions in secret. But she finally does become, as your Dr. Miri does, a gynecologist in New York's Mount Sinai Hospital?
Yes. That was a very important storyline for me. I didn't even know it when I started the book. Well, I didn't know many things about how the book would turn out, but I didn't really know that her character would become so vital to the story.
But what do you do now? It sounds like these characters, they're not leaving you.
No, it's very hard because it feels like my life's work, and yet I can't live without writing. I miss the characters deeply, and I find myself just sort of wondering from day to day, what would this person's future be like? Just even from the most minor character within the book. It's something that is still compelling me in some ways. I don't know when it's ever going to leave me.
And yet, is there some, you know, solace in the fact that you are telling their stories?
I think that there is a great solace in the fact that telling these stories are enabling me to hear other stories from different people, stories that I never would have expected to hear, especially as someone who shuts themselves up in a room and writes all day.
Meaning the people who are contacting you now.
Yes, it's incredible.
Yeah. That's Affinity Konar, her debut novel, Mischling, her combination of the horror of the Holocaust and a sort of a fairy tale way that the young victims tried to make sense of it. Affinity, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have an excerpt at hereandnow.org.
According to Twitter, the first presidential debate last night was the most tweeted about debate ever. The numbers are still being tallied, but were confirmed to be above the 10 million tweets sent out during the first presidential debate in 2012. Last night's debate was also streamed by Twitter through a partnership with Bloomberg. That was the first time they have done that. And oh, by the way, Twitter may soon be sold. For more, let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media for Recode. He joins us via Skype right now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Jeremy.
And you actually watched the debate last night on Twitter.
I did. I watched it on my laptop, and I watched some NFL football on my television. I was a good dual screen user.
Well, how did it go? How did it work on Twitter to watch the debate?
So it was very similar to how they streamed a couple of the NFL Thursday night football games last week and the week before. Essentially, they pin the feed to the top of the screen, and then you can follow tweets along the bottom and refresh your feed and see things from folks that you know at the top, and then also just see general chatter about the debate from other people on Twitter down below. So you can kind of follow the conversation while watching it all on the same screen.
Conversation is a nice way of putting some of the things that go back and forth on Twitter, especially during the debate. But, you know, probably a good thing for Twitter to get all this attention right now at the moment that people are talking about it potentially being sold. What's going on there?
We are seeing a handful of companies say, not publicly, but being reported that they're interested in making a bid for Twitter. This has been a long time coming, but I'm not surprised that they seem to be making a move right when Twitter's kind of reaching its peak.
And if you look at the companies that are reportedly considering buying Twitter, it looks like Twitter could move in very different directions depending on who ends up buying it. Salesforce, Disney, Google, all in the mix.
Yeah, we've heard Salesforce and Google, I believe, were reported last Friday to be interested. Disney was reported yesterday to be interested. I think I've heard Verizon as well. So you're right. If they go to a Disney or Verizon, it feels very much like it will be more about this live stream video distribution, right? And kind of fitting in with a media player in that way.
One more thing I want to ask you about before we let you go. The company Snap. Now, if people haven't been paying attention, they don't know that Snapchat is now called Snap. It has unveiled these new camera sunglasses called Spectacles, selling them for around $130. Tell us about them, and is it a risk for Snap to get into hardware?
So they've been working on these glasses since at least early 2015 and have been long rumored. There were some photos that leaked, you know, of CEO Evan Spiegel wearing them. But of course, the company had never officially commented, never was willing to admit they were working on them until last Friday when they had this big unveiling of the spectacles. And so imagine sunglasses, but with two little cameras in the upper corner of each eye that's going to take video and photos without the need to use your hands, right? You can have hands free to be doing other things. And in terms of a risk, I really don't think this is much of a risk for them at the moment. The reason is they've done a really nice job of framing how these glasses are fit into their business, which is that they're describing them as a toy, right? They're saying these are meant to be playful, they're fun, we're only going to create a limited number of them. They don't expect it, at least not publicly, to be a huge revenue driver. And because they're still a private company, they can kind of get away with tinkering with something like this and just seeing how it goes.
That's Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Presidential candidate Gary Johnson was mocked when he said, "What is Aleppo?" when asked about the city that, as MSNBC's Mike Barnicle said, is the epicenter of the Syrian refugee crisis. But even if you knew that, you'd be forgiven for not knowing the history of the city and why Aleppo is so important. The war has ravaged Aleppo, which was once known as the jewel of Syria, but is now half under rebel and half under pro-government control. What was Aleppo like before the civil war began in 2012? What is its history? Charles Wilkins is an associate professor of Middle East history at Wake Forest University. Let's ask him. And Professor, we understand Aleppo is one of the world's oldest continually inhabited cities.
That's correct. We have records dating it back at least to the third millennium BC. And from that time, it has been inhabited by a long series of differing civilizations and peoples. So very rich in its history.
It was an Islamic cultural capital right up there with Cairo, Constantinople. Tell us why. Is its positioning? Is its people? Why?
Well, its geographical position perhaps was strongest in determining its fate. It was placed in an area that connected Anatolia with lands to the south, that is what is today the Fertile Crescent, the Arabian Peninsula, Egypt, and to the east, Iran and India. And running east-west, of course, it connected Europe with the rest of Asia. So it was very well placed to be what was called a caravan city, with those caravans carrying goods, people, and ideas between those various points.
It was absorbed at one point into the Roman Empire, conquered by Arab Muslim troops in 636 AD. We read we're only at 636 AD. And then decades later, the Great Mosque was built. What's the significance of that?
So the Great Mosque was built by one of the earliest Islamic caliphates, the Umayyad Caliphate. Its minaret, which was destroyed during the Civil War, was an object of great beauty. The mosque itself remained in the very heart of the city, close to the markets and to all the centers of culture and, yeah, and of trade.
Well, and that's around 700 AD, as we said. Aleppo was conquered by the Mongols later. It, as we said, became part of the Ottoman Empire. But then bring us into more modern times, at least for an ancient city like this. It really started to change, if I'm reading this correctly, when France and Great Britain cut up the borders of modern Syria and cut Aleppo off from some of that caravan traffic?
That's right. Following the First World War, there was an effort by indigenous peoples, namely the Arab people, to establish an independent Arab kingdom. However, the French asserted their control over Syria and basically drew lines that separated Syria from the modern Republic of Turkey and also created Iraq and Syria. So you have various new modern political boundaries that separated the city of Aleppo from its natural hinterland that included southern Turkey today, as well as what is the city of Iskenderun or Alexandretta in Turkey. And then further to the east, it separated it from Mosul in Iraq, also an important sort of trading partner with Aleppo. So it was, in fact, a cataclysm for Aleppo, when those modern boundaries were drawn, because its economic ties were severed.
Well, then that explains its comeback after Syrian independence. Aleppo now becomes a major industrial center. I'm going to leap ahead. By 2005, it's a bustling city, mostly Sunni Muslims. What was the city like before this most recent civil war?
It was a very large city. It was a metropolis with over 2 million people, the largest city in Syria itself. But approaching the city from where I normally approached it, from Damascus, going by bus, it would be a very long ride through many, many suburbs, usually of apartment blocks, before you reach the city center, where you would find rising in the horizon the ancient citadel, the tel, on which you would find the military fortification. And then to the west side of that is the famous covered market. It's said that the square area of that market is one of the largest in the Middle East, perhaps the largest one being in Istanbul, and Aleppo being second.
It's a souk, right? A souk?
It's a souk. That's right. The souk.
Yeah. Well, so tell us a little more about, what did it feel like? What did it smell like? You know, what was a thriving Aleppo before the civil war?
Well, you would enter the ancient city through the walls, usually from the west. And as you enter it, you immediately smell spices. Walking further in, you encounter shops selling soap, olive oil. Aleppo is famed for its soap. Further on, you might even find heavy wool cloaks to wear in the cold Aleppan winters.
Bustling, thriving. I mean, these are words that we hear to describe Aleppo. Well, now, for many who are seeing Aleppo, they're seeing piles of rubble and babies being pulled from rubble. Having been there, I mean, how are you receiving that?
I can hardly put into words my emotions in seeing the city brought to its knees in this way. I mean, the bombing of the city, the besiegement of the city has forced many residents of Aleppo to flee and to relocate. So it's a depopulated city. You have a ghost town in many areas, a ghost town that is also in rubble. A very depressing picture indeed. Many of the friends, the people that I knew in Aleppo, have long since gone. People need to be constantly reminded of what is going on. I know we're so focused on national politics right now, but I fear that Syria is taking advantage of our focus on national politics to sort of rain terror upon Aleppo and other parts.
It's heartbreaking to see some of these images of infants in particular being pulled from rubble. But then you also remember this is life going on. These are infants that were somehow conceived in the middle of all of this. It's stunning.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the government-controlled part of Aleppo today, the western part, has been able to preserve some measure of normality. One can still shop. One can still even go to school, but that normality can be very fragile and gone in a second. It's amazing if we look back in historical perspective. It has suffered multiple defeats, multiple sieges. It was attacked and razed by the Mongols. Many parts of it were, and as yet, what was reborn and returned to its former grandeur. So I think that we'd be wrong to think that that Aleppo may not regain its.
You do believe that because the souk burned, great loss there. But do you think the great mosque will stand?
Well, the structure of the prayer hall is, while damaged, I think remains intact. The minaret, which I mentioned earlier, was targeted and hit and was destroyed. But I think all the pieces remain there, and it may be possible to reconstruct the minaret using photographs and other historical material. So I think there is a realistic expectation that once a war ends, they will be able to restore the mosque extensively. I hold out hope for it to be returned to its former magnificence.
And what about Aleppans? They're a huge part of the refugee crisis. I mean, you've spoken with them. You know some of them. I mean, will they return?
I think there are a significant number of Aleppans who are basically waiting it out. They're hoping for some kind of resolution. So I think they place great hopes in that city in a return to peace, and I know they want to return because I think they are aware of its enduring economic potential due to its location, its geography, its climate, et cetera.
Its history.
Its history, absolutely.
Yeah. Charles Wilkins, Associate Professor of Middle East History at Wake Forest University, answering the question, what is Aleppo? Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
This is Here and Now, and let's talk about the moderator at last night's debate, NBC's Lester Holt. Many conservatives aren't thrilled with his performance. The executive editor of the conservative media site Newsbusters said the debate was so slanted it looked like Holt took a bribe. And Trump himself weighed in this morning on Fox News. He was asked what grade he would give Holt as a moderator.
I'd give him a C+. I thought he was okay. I thought he was fine.
All right. You can
check
the box.
Nothing outstanding. I thought he gave me very unfair questions at the end, the last 3-4 questions. But, I'm not complaining about that. I thought he was okay.
Okay.
Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what grade would you give Lester Holt as the moderator last night?
I might be a little more generous than Mr. Trump was himself. I thought he did a pretty good job. Last night I said, I think, online that I thought he did well. I think he did pretty well. He navigated some tough waters there. You know, Trump in the first, call it 15, 20, 25 minutes, really rolled over both Holt and Clinton in terms of saying what he wanted to say, when he wanted to say it, clearly stretching the bounds of the timing beyond elasticity. And those were also really the best stretch Trump had all night. He did quite well on trade and jobs issues, if you recall. But I thought that Holt also weighed in at certain moments to guide the conversation. At one point, he brought Trump back when Trump was answering a question about in a way that talked about trade. And Holt reminded him the question had been, how are you going to bring all these jobs back? An assertion Trump had made without any supporting indication of policy to do so. I thought that he sort of played a fairly minimalist role and yet was constructive presence in terms of guiding the conversation and at times providing a certain reality check.
He actually did fact check Trump on the issue of whether Trump had been in favor of the Iraq war before the war started. This is something that Matt Lauer famously did not fact check Trump on at that commander-in-chief forum recently. Holt did.
Yeah, I think that Holt was present in a way that Lauer was not. Of course, he had the benefit of hindsight watching his colleague Matt Lauer be flayed online for his failure to do so. But a pretty important thing. After all, Clinton, I think rightly, particularly during the primary season, has had to answer for her decisions, for her policy voting in favor of the invasion. And it's not unfair for Trump to point out, hey, I was a private citizen and she was an actual U.S. senator, but she is publicly talked about that decision and had to account for it. You know, if he's claiming omniscience, what he did instead was point to his friend Sean Hannity of Fox News saying, look, I talked about it with that guy all the time before the war, and therefore it counts. But that was apparently in only a private setting, certainly not showing up in any transcripts of Hannity's shows over on Fox News. So if Trump wants the credit for omniscience, he needs to show that that actually occurred. Holt reasonably raised the point.
And then there was the issue of birtherism, and Holt stepped in a couple of times on that one. Let's listen.
Because I want to get on to things that are very important to me and that are very important to the country.
I'll let you respond. That's important. But I just want to get the answer here.
Do you think that Holt did enough on fact checking? A lot of people wanted him to do a lot of that. And some people didn't want him to do any of that. So that's not the role of the moderator.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a question of what role you want a moderator to play. Jim Lehrer, a very honorable, smart, good journalist, was a moderator for many years at these kinds of things. And he told me and others that what he'd like to do is a fairly, very reserved role that he almost melts away. I'm not quite in favor of that. I don't think that you're serving as a notary public where you simply attest, you know, sign some document saying you witnessed what occurred. I think you do want to, in some ways, hold all candidates in front of you to account for certain statements. But it's tricky. You know, Lester Holt at one point last night tried to fact-check a statement that Trump made about stop and frisk and a ruling in here in New York that basically held it to be unconstitutional.
Right.
But Trump actually had some valid points when he counter-argued and said that's actually not quite framing it right. It was a limited decision and that judge was later taken off the case. So there are some perils to doing this. You have to be on solid ground and you have to pick your moments. If these moderators fact-checked everything that politicians said on stage where, you know, rhetoric has to allow some modest elasticity, some greater truth that is not precise in every possible live moment of speaking, you know, that would be a back and forth that would interfere with our ability to hear what the candidates have to offer.
Well, David, what about the presentation itself on TV? We saw the candidates in split screen for the entire debate. So we could watch the whole 90 minutes, you could see the reaction shots of each candidate. What did you think about that decision? Because that's not something that's been done in previous debates.
You've seen it, if I recall correctly, in moments and in portions of past debates, but not for such an extended time
right.
as the entire debate itself. I liked it. I liked seeing their body language. I liked seeing how they responded to things. You know, one of the advantages of watching on television rather than watching on or listening on radio, if there is one to be had, is looking at facial expressions and looking at how people carry themselves. Are they respectful? Are they attentive? Are they bored? Are they sighing? What are they doing? It's not the real reason you should be tuning in, but it's part of the performative element of public leadership in a sense. And this gives you some sense of these two candidates in that way.
Well, whether you watched it on TV or listened to it on NPR, we would love to hear your thoughts on how Lester Holt did as a moderator and what would you like to see in the next debate from the moderators. Let us know at our website, hereandnow.org. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.